3, 2, 1.
Here we go. Welcome to the No Normal Show, brought to you by BPD, a marketing services firm that delivers the future to healthcare's leading brands. This show is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust, and celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the bold, all focused around the future of healthcare marketing and communications. I'm Desiree Duncan, Vice President of Health Equity and Inclusion, and today I'm joined by Chris Bevelo, Chief Transformation Officer. You've been out here in the wild, just you holding down the podcast fort. How does it feel?
I enjoy being in the podcast. I don't mind holding down the fort. And I think you should have added to the things we'll leave behind discussion of intestines. So since we covered that last week with Annie Chang, we just will leave that in the dust. Intestines in the dust. Here's a visual for you.
It took a great deal of intestinal fortitude to get through that episode.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. Yeah. That, you know what? Yeah. That took a lot of guts, Des. That took a lot of guts.
You know, I've got a strong core. All right. Enough. But yes, you had a great listen to that episode. Definitely some FOMO with yours and Stephanie's episode, but she is out traveling, living her best life all over Europe, apparently.
Ooh, and it's hot. I've been reading how hot it is. I think she's in Spain and it seems brutally hot.
Yeah.
I hope she has air conditioning access.
Staying hydrated, but excited to hear all about it when she's back.
Yes.
But, all right, so on today's episode, we're going to talk about the future, we've been talking about the future of the CMO, but we're talking a little bit next about the final opportunity. But before we jump into all of that, we've got, of course, the new Joe Public Retreat coming up for 2026. Very exciting. When am I going to get to go to one of those, Chris?
Well, we shall see. In fact, by the time this show hits the air, you will know everything you need to know about it. It's going to be in February. It is going to be in sunny South Beach, Florida. And it is going to be an amazing focus on AI. And I won't say in what way, but we have our friend Paul Raitzer, who's going to be there with us for an entire day. Because when he was with us in December, we got 2 hours of Paul, which was enough to set everybody just literally running around hair on fire. So we have something even more special planned this time. So watch for a link in the show notes for more information and how you can register. Remember, only 40 people. We only allow 40 people because we try to keep the environment super cool. We're already about a quarter full as of recording of this, and we haven't even started promoting it yet. So if you are interested, sign up quick. We'll have a wait list, but nobody likes to be on a wait list.
Yeah, it's a very exclusive opportunity, so jump on it fast and completely understand. But I'm always excited when you all come back from that because you have all of the nuggets to share. But of course, if you can't get enough of the No Normal Show and you want to stay up to date on the Joe Public Retreat, be sure to subscribe to our newsletter, The No Normal Rewind, which recaps this discussion you hear on our show today with some extra insights you won't find anywhere else. So yeah, let's jump into our show. What have you been up to?
Well, where in the world is Desiree Duncan? Where are you today? I know where you are, but this is my setup.
For
this bit. Yeah. You're in Chicago.
I am finally settling down some roots in Chicago after just about 2 years on the road. I am exhausted. I am road weary, but excited to have a brand new home. It's been quite an adventure getting to just explore and check out all of these different cities. I know I did it a few years ago, but this time around, it felt different because it wasn't COVID times. I actually got to experience the city in its true nature and not just everything being closed down. So, yeah.
So you should probably give a little more context. We have good friends that bought a really nice RV, took their 9-year-old twin daughters and spent a year, I think they're almost done, traveling around the country just for a year, visiting all the national parks, doing all this cool stuff. You did not have an RV. So explain, like, which cities, you basically went from city to city, staying there for what, a month or two, something like that? Give folks the context for your journey. The
context. Yeah. So did not do van life because life is complicated enough without having to deal with gray water. Nice. But essentially, I was looking for a new home and wanted to kind of try on a couple different cities. And essentially what I did was my partner and I, we would find a rental via Furnished Finders, where they have furnished places with all the fees of Airbnb. But it's basically the same setup that you would have at home. But loaded up our cars and hit the road, trying on different new cities, different new personas. I was for a minute there. Well, I was, my partner really loves Austin, Texas. And so I was like, okay, let me get the big 10-gallon hat. Let me get some boots. Let me go learn how to two-step. And I really put on that personality there. And then I think when we were in, I really loved Raleigh, Durham. Shout out to Vic and the team at UNC Health. I was actually really blown away. And it's got this genteel Southern nature to it and charm to it. And then I rounded out. I basically circumvented the country. I needed to be able to drive. I wasn't going to move from Seattle to like Florida because that's ridiculous. But Austin, Phoenix, Seattle, Chicago, DC, Philly, all of those great places. But ultimately, nothing beats Chicago. It's the most perfect American city.
Chicago's so amazing. Isn't it so amazing? Like, we hear so much crap about it in the news, and I know it has issues. There's a lot of issues. Dang, it is such a cool city. I love it.
And it's funny, you learn a lot about a city based off of the way that people drive in that city. But I'll write a book one day. I'll share that later at some point.
I have complete opinions on most major cities on driving alone. And Chicago is definitely a challenge city, but it's more because of its infrastructure than the drivers, in my opinion. There are drivers in other cities, and I will name like LA or Houston, that are crazy. Crazy.
Yeah. Yes.
LA is like the infrastructure plus crazy drivers. And mm-hmm. Houston, I'm in my times there over the years, just like, oh my gosh, if you're not going to 85, like, what are you doing?
What are you doing?
What are you doing? Yeah. So Miami has become a city that you can profile by traffic. Yeah.
No, that is a Formula One race everywhere you go down in South Florida.
It is.
On the flip side, Seattle, very hesitant drivers, slow, taking their time. I got road rage quite a bit. I'm like, just drive your car, please, for the love of God.
Seattle's notorious for its traffic because of its infrastructure, because 5 is like the only artery. So it's terrible.
That's it.
It's funny because Minnesota, the Twin Cities where I'm from, complains about how bad the traffic here is. And like, you have no idea. And also that Minnesota nice is infuriating. So as an example, when you exit onto a highway, what are you supposed to do, Des?
You exit? You're supposed to get over.
But how? If you're getting onto a highway from an exit, what are you supposed to be doing? Oh. Describe you as a driver.
Match the speed of the highway.
That's right. Are you supposed to stop at the bottom of the exit and look over your left shoulder for an opening?
Oh, absolutely not.
No.
Are you people doing that?
Oh, certainly. Certainly that's the case. We also have people that, because we are notorious for our passive aggressiveness, they will sit in the left lane going the speed limit. And we know this to be true because they will share it in letters to the editor where they're like, nobody should be going faster than this. So what's the problem? So they will literally police everybody else by just sticking in the left lane, going the speed limit. Welcome to Minnesota. Yes, it's true.
No,
it's a true thing. Anyway, we digress.
No. We digress. Speaking of that super highway, we had great anticipations for ChatGPT-5, but they didn't exactly pan out. I will say that we are recording this episode on August 14th, just because I know that things are changing almost every day. So when you hear this, it might be different information. But I know you and Andy chatted a little bit about some of the updates, but there's been quite a bit of backlash, especially for folks that felt that, hey, I lost my favorite what was it, the ChatGPT 4.0
and
options back. But they have brought that back. But I know, again, Chris, you have some thoughts and maybe even a little bit of a recap from your convo with Andy about it.
Yeah, I haven't spent enough time in it. What's interesting for me to really feel this, like, you know, boy, what the heck? From what I read and what I hear, what's interesting to me is this a ChatGPT-5 problem or is this a user problem? Because a lot of the feedback has been that it's less, what's the word I'm looking for? Not congealed. Congenial? Is that a word? Did I make up a word? Congenial? It's less friendly.
Congenial is one. Less friendly. Yeah. Congenial.
It's less congenial. And so is it because people feel like, oh, it's not my friend anymore and it doesn't make me feel good anymore and it's more just kind of professional and I don't like that. If that's true, then that's more of a sign that people have maybe become a tad over-reliant on AI. So I don't know. It's hard for me to suss out. I think taking away the option of 4.0 is probably a mistake. If people like it better, then give them that choice, which you said they would do. I also think they're, you know, and the thing that's funny to me is we're in such a time of two-set nation, like we talk about all the time, and part of two-set nation is the instant overreaction. People will react immediately in an overblown way. And it's like, I just saw an article yesterday that says, like, with all the issues with ChatGPT-5, has AI finally reached its limit? It's like, what? Like,
no.
Don't prescribe. I'm making up words as I go. Don't ascribe like this big whole thing to something that's been out for like a week. You know what I mean? Just calm down. There's a podcaster that I used to listen to all the time and I finally just couldn't do it anymore. His name's Bill Simmons. People who are sports fans will know Bill Simmons. Super popular, super successful, but he is the king of the instant overblown reaction. So something happens in sports and all of a sudden it's like, oh, are the Yankees done as a team forever? And I'm like, calm down. Like, we've been through this before. Like, when a quarterback does good in one game, that doesn't mean that quarterback is a Hall of Famer. And when a quarterback doesn't do good in one game, that doesn't mean that quarterback is a horror show and a complete failure. Like, just reacting to these moments. And so that's kind of where I'm at with all of this. Like, everybody just needs to chill out from both sides and give it some time. How's that?
Yeah. I hear you on that. And I guess it, in other podcasts I've listened to, they've kind of hearkened it to like when the new iPhone came out, where it's like, this doesn't feel that much different. But I still bought it. I still have it. It's doing its thing. And we'll see what else is next. Maybe a flip iPhone or something.
It's fair. It's fair to make sure the hype isn't too real, like PhD level. And we joked about this, Annie and I did, but also like when you asked it how many bees were in the word blueberry, it insisted there were three. So that's the kind of stuff that's fair to push back on. But also let's not run screaming in the streets that the world has ended because it's not exactly what we thought it would be, or it's different in some way. Like, just relax, everybody. Can't we just relax?
Relax. It's cool. Chill, guy. So I know we haven't really talked, we've touched on this a little bit, but we haven't had an episode about it, but essentially, you know, AI, what's the future of work? And I've been thinking a lot about like with young folks. There have been a couple of different articles and stories around how entry-level jobs, you know, what are those? So then if you're graduating from college, you know, what are your prospects here? I bring this all up thinking about the there's an article that came out from the KKF, the Kaiser Family Foundation, KFF, and it is around, you know, why young Americans dread turning 26 and some of the health insurance chaos that they're experiencing. And I know with the ACA, it really gave folks and adults the ability to stay on their parents' insurance plans until age 26. When before you were 18 or 19 years old, you're kicked out. Or kicked off of the insurance, not kicked out of the home, unless you were a full-time student. And so as I was reading this article, it's just like, yeah, like, I mean, most people you know, have their insurance through employer provided ways. But when you think about how the job market has changed with the gig economy, you know, with the potential shift in nature of what work is, you know, will it be much harder for students graduating to land or recent graduates to land that first job? You know, what is that going to do for the insurance? This is all coming up because of some of the changes of the ACA subsidies that are going to be ending this year, causing insurance to be even less affordable than it is with all of the political changes and regulations and all that good stuff. But yeah, it's quite a bit of a concern with what's happening. I don't know, Chris, your thoughts on any of that?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts because I have three daughters and mm-hmm. one of them turned 26. Oh, I can't remember last year. So mm-hmm. I was imploring her, please find insurance. She's like, I'm figuring it out. Because, you know, folks in their 20s, like, well, they don't have any health issues, right?
Yeah.
And what's different than before when this age extension wasn't there was getting insurance was harder, but it also was way cheaper. You've got far more people now. I don't know what the stats are, but it's not just about college graduates. Because, you know, a lot of kids in their 20s aren't going to college and can remain on their parents, whether they're looking for a job, whether they have like jobs in retail that don't give them insurance or access to insurance. So it's impacting more of those folks too. And now I have a second daughter who is approaching this. I believe might not be till 20. I'm trying to think of her age. I can't do the math. I'm terrible. 2027. So it's coming up. But you have to find it before, like when you turn 26 day one, that's when it happens, not the end of 26. So actually I think it's next year. It's just, I don't know. I could go on and on, but the fact that we have to think about and worry about this in terms of our career choices, in terms of our lives is just, I still find it mind breaking. Right? It impacts if you want to change a job. It impacts if you want to start your own thing. It impacts, you know, people in their 20s in a way that it really shouldn't. It dictates decisions at that level. And health insurance should just be a, oh, by the way, not a, this is going to dictate whether I take that job or this job or whether I can start my own business or go off on my own. I mean, that is, think how much economic challenge that provides to us in this country, where if that wasn't the case, there'd be, I would imagine, free up so much more economic value and GDP by people being able to do whatever the hell they wanted to and not worry about insurance. I don't know.
Absolutely. I know I was talking about, like, if you are going into the W-2 route, that there's a little bit of a hiccup with, you know, starting, but like so many young people have an opportunity to go more of the entrepreneurial route,
mm-hmm.
where they're working at startups, or they're, you know, they're kind of charting their own lane here. It just really creates a little bit, but just something to think about, like, you know, with the excitement of AI, with the excitement, of everything that's going on, and also some of the complexities of what's going on in the political landscape. To really keep a lot of this stuff under top of mind.
It's just one more challenge for providers, because where this hits providers is the more people who are left without insurance or adequate insurance, no matter how you're looking at it, that's a burden on providers who will provide care for those people, but then not get reimbursed for that care. So it impacts our clients, our audience in that way, but all of us as humans as well. So bleh.
Bleh.
All right, so let's
get into our main topic, which is this latest opportunity for the future of the CMO, and that essentially, I don't know about the old Chris Tucker movie, Money Talks. Money matters. It still matters. And that we, you know, in this role, looking at, you know, how do we put into, take out of, have the financial impact on our health systems and what that all looks like. I know earlier in the white paper, we talked a lot about the excitement around AI, like we were talking about earlier, some of the opportunities with, you know, the land grab of, you know, comms, or really honing in on being that whisper But this kind of really takes a look at, you know, still what's always, no matter what direction you take, this is always going to be something very critical. And I know, Chris, you have been writing about this for a number of years. So yeah, I would love to hear, of course, your perspective. I'm actually, I'm going to be a little student here today myself and listen to Prof. B. Give me a little bit of schooling on the financial implications of the CMO role.
Yeah, we thought we would do a little, let's step back and take a look at it, and specifically on ROI. Yeah, I do feel a little bit like Don Quixote. I know I'm not the only one tilting at windmills, because I've been tilting at the ROI windmill for, oh my gosh, let's say 17, 18 years, something like that. And I think we talked about this in a podcast earlier, but it's funny because we did at the HIMSS conference in April, we did a panel on defending ROI. And I kind of made a joke because we had standing room only, people like spilling into the hallway for this panel. And I said, you know, everybody comes back to these because even though we've been talking about them for 20 years, I mean, some of the people that were on the panel have been around that long, like I have. And it's like, why is this still a panel? Right? Like, why are we still here in 2025 talking about defending ROI? So let's just talk about this really quickly, because there's some basics that I think are helpful. And this goes all the way back to a book that I actually authored in 2010 called A Marketer's Guide to Measuring Results, which when it came to ROI, really relied on what I consider the gospel then and still the gospel, which was David Marlowe's book, A Marketing Guide to Measuring ROI, which was 2008. So while I took a look at measuring results across the board, David kind of wrote the first formal, you know, kind of treatise on ROI in marketing. And it still holds up today. I used to call David Marlowe the godfather of healthcare marketing. He was around in the 80s and 90s. Right. So he really knew what he was talking about. And so I'm going to reference some of that. What's interesting about marketing, about ROI, first of all, is there's a number of definitions. When we talk about marketing ROI, Marlowe calls it effort ROI, but those are interchangeable. He defines it as the revenue net of costs that comes from a specific marketing endeavor, which is, I think, how all of us think about ROI today and how we measure it. What's interesting is there's an actual finance definition. So if you go look at, like, our source for those books was Barron's Dictionary of Accounting Terms. Des, I know that's one of your favorite go-tos. I know you keep that by your bedside, always dipping into Barron's. The finance definition, yes, the finance definition is completely different. It is defined as, ROI is defined as dividing net income by average total assets. Do not ask me to go into that. I am not a finance major. I am not a CFO. But I bring it up because right from the get-go, if you are trying to drive and measure ROI from a marketing standpoint, you may run into confusion with your CFO, who may bring that definition to the table. And when you show up and say, I want to measure ROI, he or she may be like, what are you talking about? Like, this isn't really ROI. So that's just, like, right out of the gate, something to deal with. Do you want to know more about the finance definition, Des?
I think I'm good there. Yeah. My mind is just kind of thinking about even just, like, the tracking and just, like, kind of the complications. I, like, already jumped to that. Yes. But yeah.
No, let's just leave it. Let's leave that in the dust with intestines. I think that's where it belongs. Okay, so so how do you actually measure marketing ROI? And this is a very common formula that David uses. I'm going to read it to you, then I'm going to give you an example, but I think it's pretty straightforward. So the formula for marketing ROI is net revenue minus marketing expenses divided by marketing expenses times 100. All right, so that sounds really complicated. It's really not. So if you run a campaign and it costs you $250,000, we'll talk about how you define that cost in a second. And it brings you $1 million in revenue. We'll also talk about what that means in a second. So you spent $250,000, you brought in $1 million. So using that formula, that would be $1 million minus $250,000. So that's $750,000 divided by the $250,000 times 100, which would give you 300%. So according to that formula, your ROI in that situation is 300%. Most people will say that in terms of a ratio. So 3 to 1. So for every dollar you invested in that campaign, you brought in $3, thus a 3 to 1 ROI. Does that track? Is that making sense? It's okay. It's not, well, we don't have it up on a chalkboard, which we should. So if you're not able to follow that in your mind, it's pretty simple if you write it down. Does that make sense, Des? I mean, hopefully.
It does. It does, but I think it's speak where my mind went kind of speaks to kind of what the issue is with marketers. And like you start talking about finance and business and all that, and I'm just like, I'm thinking about the actual, like, okay, well, how do I track that? I'm thinking of the tech behind it and not actually understanding, like, what is the foundation? So I'm glad you brought it up and you're explaining it.
Yeah, because that formula is pretty straightforward. But once you start defining the variables in the formula, it gets tricky. And this is why you really need to figure all this out before you get to where your mind is, Des, before all of the tracking, the systems. Because if you don't have agreed upon definitions, first of all, you got to agree upon that formula with your finance people. Then you got to agree on the definitions of it. So for example, we talk about the costs, right? The costs, the marketing expenses. Well, what does that mean? So really what that's supposed to mean is the variable marketing expenses related to the efforts, right? So what are the costs that you would incur for or have incurred for this campaign that otherwise you would not have? So think creative costs, production costs, media costs. If you're working with an outside partner, an agency, a marketing firm, whatever they charge you to develop the campaign, that's what you would include for costs. What you wouldn't include are staff costs. Why? Because those are fixed. So you're spending that money no matter what you do. So you normally wouldn't include that. You would include your Marcom infrastructure. So your MarTech costs wouldn't be included there. So that's the kind of thing that you got to be clear on. And it may have to negotiate with your finance folks. On the flip side, you also have to, and this is where it gets really sticky, agree on revenue. So what do we mean by revenue? The industry standard, not just in healthcare, but in marketing overall, is contribution margin. All right. Contribution margin is, again, is that revenue that you're bringing in specific to the effort. And it's contribution margin because it is the revenue that you get to count that's left after the expenses related to that. It's not other forms of margin nor revenue. So when we say in the formula revenue, what we really mean is contribution margin, but that matters. So for example, there are kind of four different buckets of revenue. There is gross revenue, all right? Gross revenue is what your charges are. Never use charges, never use gross revenue because it's fake. It's just monopoly money. It's like, hey, for this surgery, we would normally charge $10,000. Well, good for you, but you're not getting that $10,000 because in every case, you've got a negotiated rate. So you may say you're going to charge $10,000. The insurance will tell you, no, you'll get to charge $4,000 for this. So that money is really not realistic. That $4,000 is what's called net patient revenue, which is the real revenue metric. But you shouldn't even count net patient revenue because, again, you're only counting the revenue. You're not subtracting the cost, the marketing cost from that. That's how you get the contribution margin. So if it's an orthopedic campaign and you bring in $1 million in net patient orthopedic care that you can track to this campaign, it's $1 million in net patient revenue minus, in the example before, $250,000 in marketing expenses gives you $750,000 in contribution margin. That is still different than net margin, which would tack on all of the fixed costs, not just the ones I mentioned before, but the cost of the hospital, the cost of the administrators, all of the things that are just baked in whether you spend the money or not. And if you're going that low, now you're at a point where you're not going to show any positive from anything, really, from a marketing standpoint. So you measure contribution margin for the effort. That was a lot. But that's why it's important. Like, if you don't have that agreed to ahead of time, you're going to run into a buzzsaw when you try to show up with your numbers.
So you almost need to... I don't know what, depending on your school that you went to, if you went the journalism, comms, marketing route, you definitely did not have a business.
There's my school.
That's your school.
Is it Iowa State? Oh, I can't turn around. Yeah.
I State.
Not known for its finest necessarily, but.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe I should have gone and actually taken that finance class as an elective. I guess in a way, it's like, how do we get up to speed? Like, if this isn't something that is already inherent, is it more learning on your own, building that relationship with your CFO? You know, what are the steps for something like this?
Yeah, it almost, the variables I'm talking about, whether they're revenue or cost variables, are going to vary from organization to organization, because it is that negotiation you have with your finance people. So we know people that do have to use net margin in their ROI calculation, which is just going to make it look worse in terms of their contribution, but that's not contribution margin, marketing's contribution to the organization. But that's what they have to use. We have other clients where the CFO has agreed to use net patient revenue, or to look at, there's all kinds of other things you have to think about. Like, are we getting credit for just new patients? Are we getting credit for all encounters? Are we getting credit for just the orthopedic surgeries that we bring in? Are we getting credit for subsequent procedures that we're going to get? Maybe it's in cardiology, maybe it's lifetime value. It really will depend on what your finance folks agree to. Because if they don't agree to it, you're not going to get anywhere. So it will vary. And so it's why it starts with building that foundation with them in collaboration with them. It would be great if there were industry standards. I said this to somebody yesterday. My dream is to have the Healthcare Finance Management Association and Shushmid come together and together come up with industry standards that marketers and finance people would both agree to. Then we can just all agree and not have to negotiate each time. But that is the situation now.
Yeah,
and it's tough.
And I guess when I think about this, it's also, I imagine strategy has to be a part of this as well. When I'm talking to clients, there's an issue of like, okay, like, is there access for this particular service line? Or if there's a strategy of like, okay, we want to grow more on this. So we have a couple of new surgeons in, which means we have more space and access, go get them. But let's get in. I know we're at, we have some time, but let's get a little bit into that, like that tracking of that. Like what's the formula for that?
Yeah. You've got to, if you're not sitting in hours long meeting talking about what DRGs are going to be counted, and how are, do you have the ability to track patient encounters by DRG by their payer mix? You're not having the right conversations. These can be grueling conversations. So it takes a long time to build all of that out. You have to have the finance systems. You have to have the marketing systems to be able to identify the encounters related to a specific. There's a lot there, and rather than go into all of that, because it would be even more boring than what I just talked about for the last 10 minutes. I think what's interesting is related to the future of the CMO is even when people have figured this out, Des, we call it climbing the mountain, right? If you've been able to climb the mountain and you've figured all this out and you've got the systems in place, you're able to show up and say, we spent $1 million in marketing and we are able to drive $2 million in contribution margin. I would say, I don't even know, I'm not going to put a percentage on it, but there are far fewer people who have climbed that mountain than have not, right? Most systems are still working toward that. Even when they do, many people get to the peak of that mountain and their reception is a yawn. Like, hey, thanks for the incremental $500,000. It turns out we're a $5 billion net patient revenue organization. I'm looking at an acquisition over here that's going to bring us, you know, maybe another billion in net patient revenue. And, you know, this payer provider negotiation we're in could cost us $1 billion or gain us $500 million. So what else you got, marketer? So basically, if you're not showing material impact, you all of this may be for naught, which can just sound awful to hear. Our recommendation is don't give up, don't stop. It's go big or go home. get this figured out, figure out how you can show it, and then multiply your efforts so that you can show across multiple efforts. For example, so if it's, well, we got 500,000 there, 250,000 there, and 1 million there, don't roll in separately. Bundle all of that and say all of our marketing efforts combined have brought 20 million in net new contribution margin. Right now, that's hard to ignore, no matter how big you are. But that is a reality that people are facing. So it is something that you have to think about as you move forward, because that is the point of this whole opportunity is don't give up on this. Climb the mountain. And even if the end result seems incremental, it's still valuable for the CMO to show that hit on revenue that you can drive.
All right. Well, you heard it here first. Money matters. We're going to make sure that we are able to translate that to that C-suite.
What's that podcast from NPR? It's one of my favorites of all time. Planet Money.
Planet Money. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Back when the world collapsed in 2008, Planet Money was, I think it's still out there, such a good podcast for explaining economics and finance and the world. And woof, we will not turn into Planet Money here. but I need to dust off that podcast, if that's such a thing. Mix my metaphors.
I've been more in the personal finance one, but I'll jump back into that one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that will wrap our show. And for all of you listening, don't forget that we want to hear from you. So shoot us an email at nonormal@bpdhealthcare.com so that your question may be featured in our next episode. And make sure you share the show with friends and colleagues and give us a review and a rating on iTunes and Spotify, preferably 5 stars. All of that would be greatly appreciated. And until next time, don't ever be satisfied with the normal. Push that no normal, y'all, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
3, 2, 1.